Am I right in assuming your main message here is that people shouldn't look at this as some sort of cowboys and Indians, goodies versus baddies, that both sides are somewhat lacking in moral virtue?
The conflict in Syria is much more complex than just a simple rebellion of the populace against an oppressive regime. There is an oppressive regime, and many people would like to be rid of it. But the regime also has its internal supporters in large sectors of the among large sectors of the population, as well as its opponents. On the opposition side, there are peaceful opponents of the regime who have taken part in peaceful demonstrations and have been very severely repressed by the regime as a result. But there is also an armed opposition which is badly fractured and includes those who want Syria to become a democracy, as well as those who want to see Syria become a Sunni Muslim theocracy. It's not at all a simple matter of right and wrong and good and bad.
It's certainly not simple, but if you remember, since it's your current residence, there's the old Irish directions to somebody who was lost: if I was you, I wouldn't start from here. While admitting that there are no angels on either side, do you see any way out of this current impasse, apart from a sort of grisly future of looking like a supersized Lebanon?
There are voices within Syria calling for a peaceful transition and negotiations that lead to a peaceful transition, and I would suspect that that's probably the only way forward that won't further destroy the country. There's an interesting op-ed piece in today's Financial Times by Mark Gregorios, the Syrian Orthodox Bishop of Aleppo, in which he calls for the outside powers who are backing both sides in the conflict to help to bring both sides to the table to oversee a transition that will lead to free elections and a new kind of government in Syria.
There's always a danger when you call for sort of non-violence as a principle. For example, Gandhi, the British might have been nasty imperialists, but Gandhi could get away with non-violence. If he tried it against the Third Reich, they would have just run the tanks over him. So, when you call for non-violence, in principle, it's fine, but how does that work when you've got a regime prepared to send tanks and fighter bombers against its own cities and people?
Well, as some of the people I spoke to and that I quote in my article in the current London New York Review of Books, as they said, that the regime is built to deal with violence. It's not built to deal with nonviolence. It's never had to face nonviolent a nonviolent uprising before. It's faced attempted coups d'état. It's faced a rebellion by the Muslim Brothers from 1979 to 1982, and it had inoculated itself against this kind of thing, and that's why the regime has shown itself to be so strong, and is still here. Almost into its third year of this uprising, when at the very beginning, outside observers in the United States and elsewhere were saying that the regime would crack any minute. Well, the regime has not cracked. It's lost ground, but it's still there and it's still fighting rather effectively.
Well, one of the points, of course, is that as you said, there are substantial minorities who initially might have been or more agnostic about the regime than many of their compatriots, but their survival is bound in. Now, you mentioned the Orthodox, and something like in Iraq, the Alawite minority that's actually ruling, plus the Christians, the Yazidis, and others, are looking over their shoulders at the Salafists and thinking, we are better off with Al-Assad than we are with those people. How can they be reassured? Because it struck me from the beginning.
The regime in Damascus, for all of its flaws, and they are many, is a secular regime. And that when it declared itself a secular regime, that's what initiated the Muslim Brotherhood uprising against it in the late 1970s. It's the secularism that upsets the religious fundamentalists in the country. They also upset the people who are in the regime, and I speak foremost of the president and his father. They are Alawites, and many devout Sunnis regard Alawites as Muslim heretics, and they do not want to be ruled by Muslim heretics, but they are fighting a religious, they are fighting a religious war. The regime itself is trying to preserve secularism, and many people in the opposition, while not wanting this regime, not because it's Alawite, but because it's a dictatorship, don't want this regime, but they want to preserve the secular institutions of the state. And many of those people would like to end the fighting before those institutions are completely destroyed.
Yes, would you, I'm probing a little here, the Ba'athist party has now almost been taken over by the Alawites. To what extent are they actually secular and not just covering their ears on the grounds that any majority fundamentalist state is going to disadvantage them, who are pretty much a ruling minority?
Well, many Alawites are afraid that if a Sunni fundamentalist regime comes in, that they will be oppressed on a religious basis, which they certainly would be. If a democracy comes to Syria and the rights of all minorities can be protected, then the Alawites should survive. And the Alawites as a whole have not benefited much from the Alawite regime. The immediate family of the president and his cronies have benefited, but if you go to the Alawite villages in northwest Syria, they are probably still the poorest parts of the country. This is a largely peasant population who have not benefited at all.
So can any of this be done without... Outside intervention seems to be almost the worst thing that could happen, except all of the alternatives, as it was said. I mean,
outside intervention since the uprising began. I mean, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks have been arming opponents of the regime from the very beginning. That is outside intervention. Now it's increased as the British and the French have come in, and as the United States is providing logistical and communication support to the opposition and to various groups within the opposition, because there is no united, coherent, armed opposition. And if these groups do manage ultimately to drive the regime from power, they will then be at one another's throats to see which of them will prevail.
You introduced the international dimension there. Once again, in retrospect, to what extent do you think the Russians and the Chinese are culpable because they were sending sort of false signals of optimism to the regime, and in a sense, perhaps allowing
The Chinese are not major actors in this drama. The Russians and the Iranians are the two main props of the Syrian regime from the outside. And the Russians continue to send weapons to the army, and the Iranians continue to send weapons and some people to help the regime to crush the rebellion. And they, their interference is probably as counterproductive as the Western and Saudi Arabian interference on the other side.
Which really leaves us under the spinning compass, wondering which direction with safety lies. And at one point, it looked as though the Turks had enough credibility that they could have, say, come in and protected the Alawites, perhaps, offered some guarantees.
I don't think that the Alawites ever thought they'd be protected by the Turks. And you have to remember, the two communities in Syria that most fear the Turks are the Alawites, because their cousins, the Alevis, on the Turkish side of the border in that area,
and of course
have suffered greatly under Turkish administrations. They've not been allowed to speak Arabic. They've had to change their names to Turkish names. The Alawites of Syria would not welcome a Turkish intervention. And the Armenians, who live mainly in and around Aleppo, would certainly not, with their memories of the Armenian Holocaust during the First World War, would certainly not welcome Turkish intervention. In fact, that's one of their greatest fears.
This has to be done inside Syria, but there doesn't seem to be any credible forces that can do it, because of the opposition is fragmented, and the central government, the regime itself, seems to be more and more isolated.
This is clearly why it's all the more urgent to have negotiations that will lead to a transition that the majority of the Syrian people will accept. And I unfortunately don't see many people moving in that direction. There are talks going on, sponsored by the San Egidio community in Rome, who've gathered much of the opposition together with some interlocutors from the regime. But without political pressure from outside moving those negotiations, they're not likely to succeed.
But a lot of this, of course, the regime is But whatever was there was of ideology in the Ba'athist Party is now down to the president and his family. Can they be persuaded to go peacefully?
Well, Bashar al-Assad's term of office ends in 2014. If he thought that he could stay until the end of his term, hold an election, which he would undoubtedly lose, then he could go and save face, and his supporters in the country would feel that they'd been vindicated and all would be well, and the opposition would then come to power by the ballot box rather than by weapons.
So your negotiated settlement would basically be free elections to be held in 2014 with a transition perhaps coalition government in the meantime?
Something along those lines, or something along the lines that were introduced in Zimbabwe that brought the Movement for Democratic Change into the government in Zimbabwe. Some way of avoiding all-out massacre.
Yeah, and it didn't do too much in Zimbabwe in the end, since it Mugabe is hardly a role model for stepping down gracefully.
No, but Mugabe has a limitless term of office, and it seems to live much longer than anyone ever thought he would live. But the constitution of Syria doesn't allow Bashar Assad to serve a third term, so he would have to go anyway.
Mm-hmm. But part of this would be who would trust whom. Once again, it comes to the point is whether there's outside representatives, tokens, United Nations, whoever, who could be relied on to be honest brokers here.
Well, you either have negotiations and come to some kind of an understanding to avoid the war, or you prolong the war, escalate the war, and destroy the country. I mean, I've walked around the sections of Damascus and Aleppo that have been totally destroyed by this war, and they will become representative of most of Syria if the fighting goes on. So you either do that, or you take a chance on a negotiated settlement.
No, I mean, I share your horror at that, because these are some of the oldest and most beautiful cities in the world, and actually relatively unspoiled by modernization until now, many of them, aren't they?
Well, particularly in Aleppo. Aleppo, according to UNESCO, you remember Aleppo is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has 80% of its medieval architecture intact, or did until the fighting began, that which is unique in the world.
Yes. It's not, and it doesn't seem to be holding up well at the moment, does it? I think that should cover everything, Charles. But do you want to repeat your book for us, with Tribes with Flags, to give us the details?
Tribes with Flags is coming out in a new edition from Grove Atlantic as I speak. My name is Charles Glass. I wrote a book called Tribes with Flags, which is being reissued in a new edition now by Grove Atlantic. I'm here giving an interview to syndicatednews.net.